You're listening to Talking About Organizations, brought to you with the support of Innovation, Knowledge, and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 10! What an occasion! Since we started talking about organizations, our topics included Frederick Winslow Taylor, Henri Fayol, Abraham Maslow, Carnegie Mellon School, Mary Parker Follett, Max Weber, Chester Bernard, and Elton Mayo. It's somewhat hard to believe that we did all this in just the 7 preceding months to this episode. So now, for episode 10, in the words of Monty Python, it's time for something completely different. To treat you and ourselves, we're going to go to the movies, and the topic for episode 10 is a classic film, 12 Angry Men, with Henry Fonda. And you can learn all about that, as always, on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, speaking to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
This is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington in the United Kingdom.
This is Pedro, coming to you from New York City in a very beautiful spring day.
This is Dr. Ralph, coming to you from 1,600 meters above sea level, Albuquerque, New Mexico, home of the Balloonist Box.
What is that?
Box. It's, yeah. So it's a place where balloonists can go at a certain altitude, blow one way with the wind, and then they change their altitude and they come blow back the other direction. So it's unique atmospheric conditions in the United States.
Ah. Well, welcome everybody, and congratulations on making it to double digits. Yay!
Yay!
Hooray!
Also, this is the first time we are all back together since the 2nd of February, when episode 6 on Weber was released.
Yay!
True!
Yeah, it's been
the family
long.
Reunion.
Something like that, yes. So, 12 Angry Men, it's one of the classic things that is considered in business schools during teaching of group dynamics and conflict resolution, apparently. And there's a few reasons why we're watching this film, aside from its aesthetic value, and it's just a really interesting piece of artistic work. So films as an educational tool, one of the things they can do is illustrate topics in a more accessible way than reading a text, especially if that text is an academic journal article. But also they relate to people on a level of storytelling, and narratives are an essential component of individual sense-making, which I believe is something Carl Weick said, a good friend of the podcast. So we are here, and we are very excited to share our experiences of watching, or I think more accurately would be re-watching this lovely film. I think a brief synopsis may be in order before we proceed, especially if someone hasn't seen this. But if you haven't, you should really pause now, go to YouTube and watch this amazing piece of work, and then come back and finish listening, because we're not going anywhere, and well, neither is the film, but it's just going to be so much better. Who wants to give a brief introduction to what it is that is so significant about this work?
I can. So it's an interesting application of leadership theory and cooperative activity and emergence in organizations. Essentially, it concludes or begins with the conclusion of a trial where the jurors go off to deliver the verdict, and then it takes you through the interactions and difficulties the jurors experience trying to make order out of a ill-structured task. You'd think that jury deliberations would be very well structured, but the movie illustrates many aspects of it that are ill-structured. And you get to watch the evolution of the people's thinking as revealed by their words and actions. You don't really know what they're thinking, but it starts out where it's 11-1 in favor of a guilty verdict for someone who's accused of murder, which means in the United States at the time it was considered a capital crime, which meant that the person would probably be executed as a result. And then it you follow the dynamics amongst the jurors as it slowly shifts into more and more jurors being in favor of being not guilty. And what's interesting, many interesting features about the films is the jurors are not referred to by name. In fact, they don't refer to each other as by name, and even in a script, they're just given numbers. And it actually isn't until the very end of the story that two of the jurors on walking out introduce each other and to introduce themselves, and you actually learn their names. And then those are the only two jurors whose names you know. So that's my brief synopsis of the film.
Yeah, I think, should I briefly introduce who are the 12 men that are allegedly angry throughout this film?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yes, it's probably a good idea.
All right, so number one is the foreman. He is also the facilitator for the group, and he is an assistant high school football coach. Person number two is a bank clerk. He has a very childish voice and is frequently dominated by others throughout the film, but he does stand his own ground towards the end. Number three is a businessman and probably the main antagonist, if such a term can apply here. He is a distraught father whose son left him, and he is quite temperamental and very stubborn. Number four is a rational stockbroker. He is unflappable, self-assured, and analytical. Number five is a man from a slum, as he is described in the screenplay. Number six is a house painter. He is tough but principled and generally respectful. Number seven is a salesman, a sports fan who is fairly superficial and indifferent to the whole process and pretty much just wants to get out of there as soon as possible. Number eight, that would be Henry Fonda. He's an architect and the person who was the first and only one to say not guilty at the beginning of the film. Number nine is a wise and observant elderly man. Number 10 is a garage owner. He's quite pushy and significantly loud. Number 11 is a European immigrant watchmaker. And number 12 is an indecisive advertising executive. So this is the ecology of the jury room where they deliberate on the outcome of the case. And, you know, it's quite... The composition of these individuals, whilst as random as it may seem, it's familiar. You know, have you been in situations where you just end up with such a colorful collection of different characters and motivations, and you basically have to come to a conclusion of some sort? I know I have.
Yes, I have been many times. And one thing I want to point out about the introductions is that you don't know any of that stuff that Dimitri's just reported by watching the movie. That's in the screenplay. So all you know is how they behave and speak in the movie. And these things kind of make sense. And you can see the people who cast the movie were trying to stay true to the screenplay. But you don't know their names, and you actually don't know their professions outright. Sometimes it's revealed through the dialogue, but sometimes not.
I was just going to say, yes, I think that in response to what Dimitri was saying, this kind of, you know, heterogeneous group situations are part of either universities or workplace or even informal settings that we go like apart. You know, I think it's pretty much common throughout our life.
I'd also like to add that if there's always one thing that has impressed me about this film is that while at the beginning all the characters look the same, they are similar on an appearance level. Like, they're all, with some exceptions, white men, mid-aged. There are only, I think, watching it for the first time, there were only two characters which kind of like stood out, which is the elderly guy and the one with the foreign accent. But then when you go through the film, you actually uncover how they are all individual, particular. They've got all specific storylines, a very, very different one from the other. So this is something that has always impressed me.
That's true.
It's a very hot summer afternoon, in a large, drab, bare room in need of painting, with three windows in the back wall through which can be seen the New York City skyline, are these 12 men. They have a toilet in there and a large scarred table, and they are locked in there. This will be revealed quite early in the film, but I think it creates an atmosphere of not only immediacy that they're there and they actually can't go anywhere else except the toilet room, which is where some of the interesting conversations later take place, but they're there, they need to fulfill this objective in order to get out, and the objective is to deliver a unanimous verdict to the case. So it starts off quite promising in that 11 men vote guilty, but Henry Fonda says hold on, and the whole film kicks off from there on. But the heat, the desire to be elsewhere, the unflattering surroundings, and the very fact that they can't leave is a fantastic setting in which to perform this situation that these people are going through. Because whilst perhaps we're not likely to find ourselves in exact same circumstances, the locks, they also frequently can be deadlines or some other commitments that you can't get out of. All in all, there is so much resonance between how this is set to what one is likely to experience in a working life that, honestly, I'm not really surprised that it is used in business schools to show and simulate and play out various conflict resolution scenarios. So that is the point why we're looking at this today.
If I can add something, there's this atmosphere within the room of kind of like a closed room situation. I'm not sure if that is English. They're isolated from the external world. But the scenes before that, which kind of like relate to the external world, are in the courtroom where the judge gives a general outline of what the purpose of the task is. And if you go one scene before, the first scene shows the building of the courthouse, and at the top of the shot you read kind of like the writing on the courthouse, which is the administration of justice is the firmest pillar of good. So this idea of the general aim, which is for justice and for good, and something that then in the closed room, it kind of like falls out of the picture. I'm not sure if anyone noticed this.
Ah, I did not. But it is interesting that justice is good and presumably good is justice.
Yes, that's, and then you have people that are looking at the game and when it starts and they want to go home, and other priorities come into place.
Right, well, shall we introduce, before we get into the film, some kind of a structure to our discussion? As this is not a reading, we can't go chapter by chapter, really.
Okay, what structure would be?
So here's just one way to think about it. So at one level, there's the narrative as you go through, and I think we will largely go through it that way. One other area to look at structure, and this isn't going to define the way we talk about it, but I think these are things that readers want, the listeners to the podcast will want to pay attention to as we go through them, is what I've termed turning points in the narrative that are highly impactful and have great consequences. So the first one is where juror 8 starts out after they've taken the initial vote, and it's 11-1, as Demetrius said, and the other jurors are very surprised that one person voted for not guilty. And juror 8 starts out by saying, "I don't want to change your mind. I just want to talk." So he's not saying that he needs everybody to agree with him. He paints the picture of, we just need to talk about what's going on. Then the next turning point I noticed, and these are just the things that I observed, is when juror 12 induces the foreman to have each juror state why he is convinced of the defendant's guilt. In other words, this gets all the jurors actively involved in helping convince or stating their understanding of the case and helping to convince or trying to convince Juror 8. And then Juror 8 begins, and this isn't immediately thereafter, Juror 8 questions the performance of defense counsel. So now he's laid something that everybody's apparently up until now, the other jurors have taken for granted, that this is just the facts of the case. Here's how they're presented, and we're going to go interpret them. And Juror 8 says that he doesn't think the defense counsel did a very good job and is now going to go deeper into the evidence. And that basically sets the stage for the next turning point, where Juror 8 is the first time a member of the jury asks to see evidence. And Juror 8 asks to see the switchblade knife, which begins the process of deconstructing the elements of the prosecution's case step by step. Then later, Juror 8 asks for a secret ballot, which this is all very early in the movie. And what's interesting about the secret ballot is he doesn't vote. And he basically tells people, I'm not going to vote. And if it's still 11-0, then I'm done. And I won't go any further. And then there's a resolving of the conflict over declaring a hung jury. There's several times that comes up, and some of the jurors say, I'm not going to change my mind. You can't make me change my mind. And they appear steadfast in their willingness to just go back to the judge and declare what's called a hung jury, which means the jury cannot reach a unanimous verdict. And that means that a new trial has to be performed. And then in the United States, the prosecution has the option of actually not carrying forth a second trial. The prosecution can decline to try it again. Many times they do, but they don't have to. And then that means you'd get 12 brand new jurors, and they would completely redo the case. And then the last turning point I noticed was where Juror 10 completely destroys his credibility after the 10-3 vote, whereas 10 vote to acquit and 3 do not, with a long racist rant that turns all the jurors against him. And then there's actually sort of some final places, but I thought those were some of the biggest turning points.
Yeah, we can go around that.
I think they'll come up. I mean, as we go through, we don't have to focus on those, but they those things will come up as we're talking about. So I just thought those would be good markers for the listeners as we're going through the case to help them see where the points of greatest significance are.
I was just going to say that I think it's important to highlight here that there is a progression. You know, that's the main idea of the movie. That while you at the beginning only have one person that votes not guilty, and then, you know, slowly as the deconstruction, as you said, go and people start to be more inquisitive and think through, slowly, like, each one changes your mind and have, like, clear grounds to do that, usually. So I think that's the main idea of the movie, you know, like this progression, almost like a crescendo. If it was a music.
I agree with this idea of progression and of turning points within the script. I would also add that there are many opportunities for reflection on other themes. So besides ideas of leadership, I think we could also spend a bit of time on talking about the environment that we've already kind of mentioned. This closed situation, a very uncomfortable environment in which there's a massive heat wave, they can't open the windows, they can't get the fan to work, these kind of things. Then I think another interesting point that I jotted down was, in relation to progression, the idea of motivation. Therefore, motivation, how it evolves over time. You have someone who's like, I've got tickets for a game. I can't remember what game, a sports game, something, in a couple of hours. So thank you. I would like to get it done. And someone else who's like, oh, it's all clear. And someone who's got greater issues. And with this, I'm referring to the father whose son left him some years ago. So motivation would be another cornerstone that I would like to discuss. I'm not sure if I've got any major other cornerstones.
Can I just expand on that? Because that's also what I was thinking was watching the movie, which is trying to reflect on what we have been discussing thus far with all these theories, you know, and how they might shed some light in some of the things we watched in the movie. So Miranda talks something about motivation, Ralph and Dimitri are talking more about leadership, but I think there's also something more typical organizational topics like decision making and routines, you know, the way you design a task and how much autonomy is embedded in that, which, you know, go back to people like Taylor, Weber, the Carnegie Mellon folks, and something that, you know, This whole idea of crescendo and motivation and this construction group work that Rob was referring leads to Follett. So I think that it's a very good setting to kind of to bring to bear the things we have been discussing and learning from each other.
Fantastic. So that sounds like a plan.
So a little bit of narrative, but it's basically just gives an ability for us to jump in and address these issues. So in Act 1, they file into the jury room and they take an initial ballot and it's public. They just go around the table. They all get on the table in order of their jury sequence number. And that's the order they maintain for the rest of the movie, which is an interesting point because it talks about, you know, task design and structure and those kinds of things. But they do a vote and it's 11-1. Only juror 8 votes for not guilty. And then
Can I add something? So if there's something that I noticed is that if you want to look at this from a leadership perspective, so try to identify themes of leadership, there's something to do with definitely leadership styles or maybe sources of leadership. So the person who takes the first leadership role is more on a formal level and it is juror number 1, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who is the foreman, who I've never been in a jury, so I don't know how these things work, but I've seen a lot of films and series on it. So I'm presuming that the foreman is the one who is who has the role of kind of like guiding the rest of the jurors. And he's the one that comes up with the idea of the votes and of structuring things like that. So he's kind of like the more formal leader. Could we say that? What do you think?
He's something like an administrator, I would suppose.
Okay.
Yeah, or facilitator, either way. Yeah, and I think you're right. By he has a leadership actions designated by role. And what you don't see in the movie is that the judge usually spends some time instructing the foreman as part of the proceedings as to what his or her role is supposed to be. And that's left out of the play. I guess it's assumed that people know that what that would be, or that it's not central. But I think that was a very good point, Miranda, that he's pretty much the only one in the room has a formal leadership role.
So mm-hmm. what I saw in him was someone who was more concerned at the beginning of guaranteeing the smooth running of the procedure, of getting things done in the smoothest way possible. Not sure if my interpretation is...
I think you're right, because you actually see him asserting himself that way many times, where he's trying to get people to cooperate or stop arguing or place votes and he's going sequentially around the table and asking people what their views are to state their rationale for guilty. And that's what it looked like to me too.
Well, let's hear from how he announces his role at the beginning.
Okay, gentlemen, if I can have your attention. You fellas can handle this thing any way that you want to. I'm not going to make any rules. We can, well, discuss it first and then vote on it. That's, of course, one way. And, we can vote on it right now.
And it's cool voice inserts like that we'll be having throughout. Surprise. But yeah, he's not particular. I wouldn't go as far as to say that he is keen on guaranteeing anything, but he is following the more or less the guidelines issued to him by the court, really. And he does get disgruntled from time to time, and quickly, I think, this anything that's above or beyond the administrative role or function that he fulfills is quickly taken over by other jurors, and Henry Fonda, juror number 8, not being the least of them.
And yes.
It's actually something that surprised...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's something that surprised me, that how little structure there is in such an important process, if you will, in deciding someone's life.
Yeah, well, and I agree with you. And notice how he doesn't take an authoritative approach. It's more of a suggestion, polite suggestion. And he opens it up to input from the other members of the jury. And so it is interesting that it's low structure. And then he's also taken a low-key approach.
Right. But despite that, we immediately get immersed into a very vivid social hierarchy where these 12 or the 11 other really uncomfortable man, who most of them don't want to be there, try to form something of a cooperative system or a collaborative system, yes, at least. And that's, yes, where most of the juicy activity begins in the film. That so they begin voting by raising hands.
Just remember that this has to be 12-0 either way. That's the law. Okay, are we ready? All those voting guilty, please raise your hands. 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, that's 11 guilty. All those voting not guilty? 1. Right. 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. Well, now we know where we are.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
So, what are we doing now?
I guess we talk.
Boy, oh boy.
And juror number 10 is not happy with that proposition at all. So we have a social dynamic immediately trying to remove any kind of dissent from the situation, and that's certainly something very key to group dynamics, and especially if you consider the whole George Orwell groupthink idea that groups are generally not tremendously keen on reflection.
Yeah, it's called riding the bus is what they refer to it as. And so the idea is, you know, do you feel like you have a chance to influence the proceedings or the outcome? Or are you just there to, like juror number 7, who just wants to get it over with, doesn't really want to be there, makes no secret of the fact. He's probably the most vocal, although other jurors express some similar concerns, but he's probably the most vocal that this, the whole proceedings means very little to him. And he's much more interested in the baseball game that comes afterwards. And therefore, he just considers a small schedule interruption for his baseball game.
He also has his mind made up a priori. After they cast the votes and there's a bit of an argument, he was challenged whether it's so easy for him to convince a man, or a boy really in this case, the accused is 16 years old, Puerto Rican fella, to send this boy to death. And he says that, well, just because I voted fast, I think the guy's guilty. You couldn't change my mind if we talked for 100 years. And then suppose you're wrong. Suppose this whole building falls on my head. You can't suppose anything. So he's very predetermined to just get it over with, really, as what you said.
Yeah, well, and he has... There's a couple other really good quotes that he makes that I think indicate that. One is, some of us have got better things to do than sit around a jury room. And then he says something that really – so nobody really responds very quickly to that. But he does later he says, do me a favor. Wake me up when this is over, when juror 8 is trying to make points. And there's several of the jury members actually take exception to that he's basically – sounds like he's intellectually checking out of the process, which you do see – in group behaviors, some people are reluctant to contribute or step in, and others basically just mentally check out, and that makes it difficult to get full participation in the group.
Yes, and there was also no clear indication as to what they were supposed to look at. So the beginning of the discussion falls into where the boy comes from, what kind of environment, giving explanations. What was going on in the house, what was going on in that neighborhood, these kind of things. And someone says, I cannot recall precisely who, that they shouldn't be looking at the reasons at the explanation, but just at the evidence if it is fact. So in you kind of see that there are no guidelines, there are no criteria, but that the group of people try to make them on their own and try to shape them along the way. Even this idea of voting every, having different rounds of votes was a thing that they came up with just to see how the numbers were and worked.
Yeah. But here I would like to make a theoretical point based a bit on the fieldwork I did and watching people deciding on things and meetings and etc. And the first thing that strikes me here is that, again, there is no structure, so there is not even like a minimal amount of time they have to be in the room for some things like that, you know. So then you can easily create these moments that people just want to get over it and leave in 10 minutes, or there is no procedure to be followed, like a basic one, like you have to at least inspect the five main exhibits or to have enough time to discuss the main proposition of both parts. There is nothing like that. So again, that was my first feeling of uncomfortable towards what was going on, because there's no way to at least lead people to be willing to talk.
Yeah, now I will say that some things of the official jury process and court process are left out of the movie for sake of dramatic effect, and they're actually revealed in the course of the movie. So the idea about juror instruction, they get lots of instruction about what they're allowed to consider and what they're allowed to do. For example, in U.S. courtrooms, you are not allowed, jurors cannot take notes during the trial. The only thing you can refer to is the official court transcript. So you can ask to have those brought in, but you're not allowed to have any notes. And you're given very specific instructions about things like that. And so that's left out of the movie, and it's revealed in the course of the movie. So they do get instruction on that. It's just not part of the movie script.
Henry Fonda, juror number 8, he blocked the group decision because it recalled that it had to be unanimous for them to be able to pass one either way, and they were leaning towards guilty at first, 11-1. So he blocked their decision by saying, "I don't think he's guilty. Let's talk about it." And he thus opened up a space for further dialogue, because now, in effect, either he has to convince them, or they have to convince him. And that's where I suppose much of the leadership interest is. It lies therein.
Can I add a precision in terms of use of words? He doesn't say, Henry Fonda doesn't really say, "I don't think he's guilty," even if he does think this, because a guy that goes, I mean, this is the impression I have, but he actually says, "I don't know if he's guilty." So he is constantly referring to the concept of reasonable doubt, which is what is introduced by the judge at the beginning, saying that if you have a minimum of reasonable doubt, you cannot send him to the chair.
Well, and even early on, what he says is, "I'm not trying to change anybody's mind," words to that effect. "I just want to talk about it." That's what Miranda was saying. And I think that's a very important leadership approach he takes, because he's not telling people it has to be done this way, or I don't agree with you, and, you know, confronting it. He basically says, opens, and I think this, he creates the space, I think it was Demetrius that said that, for the dialogue that ensues, and the jurors find their own structure inside of that space that he just opened up.
This is, I think, quite insightful, that instead of cornering people into a box of some sort, of, you know, giving a structure of them and us, if he said that you're all wrong, he's not guilty, and that's not very conducive to any kind of deliberation that is constructive, and probably might need to have had another murder trial at the end of that, mm-hmm. given how testy all the angry men were in the film, repeatedly almost fighting each other.
I was just going to say that, you know, we start to enter like the whole different idea of leadership and management and everything, you know, and I think of people like Follett and that we discussed, that, you know, it's less about who is commanding who and directly issuing orders or direct positions, and more about thinking together in a way and being able to, I don't know, create, as you said, create the space for thinking to ensue, and to be able to, I don't know, re-examine the situation, which is simple yet powerful.
Well, I think one of the other aspects of Follett is, and it applies here, I just thought about, is that Follett advocates, you know, going to where the source of knowledge is, but not necessarily deferring, but allowing people who have local knowledge to influence the, you know, decisions and group actions. And you see that repeatedly in the movie, where somebody will have some level of expertise and they will bring that to bear, and that is often very persuasive for the other jurors, where somebody can say, "Well, I've seen a switchblade knife, I've seen knife fights before, and here's how you hold the knife," and those kinds of things, and they find that, what it appears, the jurors find that much more convincing than when juror three says, "Oh yeah, you could stab this way," and you know, give some kind of demonstration. In fact, in some ways, the jurors are horrified when they see juror three apparently attempting to mimic the stab wounds on juror number eight. There's a lot of concern there when he's flinging the knife around.
I really like the idea of, you know, creating the space for people's own knowledge to be brought to light. And I think that's what happens a lot in the whole process, is that exactly juror eight makes people think and reason on their own prior knowledge. For, I know, I remember the whole issue of, you know, the whole, it's later in the narrative, I don't want to get into that so much now, but the whole thing of the train and how loud is the train and so on, and people have experience on that. So he enables the space for people to bring what they know indirectly about that case, which is, again, goes a different way of leadership.
I think there's also an indirect questioning of stereotypes. So this idea of what goes on in the neighborhood, where does this boy come from, what kind of family it is, it's never really openly indicated as a stereotype or a preconception, but it's there throughout.
Well, and actually later, it's actually very dramatically brought forward by juror 10, where he talks about how you can't trust him and this. And I thought it was really interesting when he's, because a couple of jurors said, what a terrible way to think about people, or what a terrible way to think. And in this part of this early part in Act One, as the jurors are going around stating what they found convincing and working at changing juror number eight's mind, that it's interesting that juror 10, I guess it is, he's talking about the testimony of one of the witnesses, and juror 8 looks at him and says, "How come you believed the testimony of the woman across the street? She's one of them, isn't she?" And he's basically got no reply. So it was a very effective smackdown of that racist stereotype that he was advocating earlier, where you couldn't believe anything they say and they're all liars and that kind of thing.
And did you catch up on the point where someone says, "Oh, they don't even speak English correctly," or something like that, and he actually said it?
Oh yeah, that was great. That was great. The guy next to him say it doesn't correct his English. Oh, that was a great smackdown.
I just want to go back to what Miranda said, because I think, I mean, I don't want to say disagree, but I think it's very evident in the movie, the whole thing of the prejudice and the whole stereotypes dynamics. If you think, even the very fact that, you know, juror 8, who is the first one to say not guilty, is a very, I say, he has a white collar job as an architect, has kids, you know, a white, well, they're all white men, but, you know, he's of a certain kind of white.
Yeah, so that's very instructive. Yeah.
But I mean, I think the fact that he, and there's a lot of discussion about race and how much, you know, sometimes people can be allies to minorities and create, you know, the space to other people to rethink their points because they are similar. So I think, see what I'm trying to say? So I think the very fact that his voice is heard because he's a person of a certain status is already, you know, indicative of the whole thing.
And that's all for the first half of episode 10. Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for more information on what's to follow, future episodes, and our blog. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we're very eager to hear from you. You can do so via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, where you can send us a direct email. We very much hope to see you next week as we conclude our discussion of 12 Angry Men, here on Talking About Organizations.